Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jeremy Sherlich, senior producer of The President's Inbox. As many of you know, this show was meant to be a limited-run series leading up to the inauguration of soon-to-be President Trump. However, because of overwhelming interest in the show and calls from our listeners to extend past January 20th, we decided to listen to you and keep going. We're going to take a short break while we prepare more episodes, but we'll be back in time for the president's first week in office to once again look at international issues topping the inbox. In the meantime, here's Jim and Bob with today's episode. Thanks for listening.
On January 20, 2017, Donald J. Trump will take the oath of office as the 45th President of the United States. When he does so, the conversation will shift from what he might do to what he is doing. On election night, Trump laid out his vision for what he hopes to accomplish. Here's a clip from his victory speech.
We have a great economic plan. We will double our growth and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world. I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone. We will seek common ground, not hostility. Partnership, not conflict. And I can only say that while the campaign is over, our work on this movement is now really just beginning. We're going to get to work immediately for the American people.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, the CFR podcast that examines the challenges at the top of the next president's foreign policy inbox. We discuss what President-elect Donald Trump has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week on The President's Inbox, we are looking at the world that Donald Trump is inheriting.
With us this week is Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. His extensive government experience includes service under President George H.W. Bush as Special Assistant and the National Security Council's Senior Director for Near East and South Asian Affairs. From 2001 to 2003 under President George W. Bush, Richard directed policy planning for the Department of State. He's written numerous books on international affairs and U.S. foreign policy, and his latest couldn't be more timely. The book is called A World in Disarray: American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, and was published just this month. So Richard, taking a cue from your book's title, we'd like to start things off by having you describe the kind of world Donald Trump will face when he takes office.
Well, the world the 45th president will inherit will, in fact, be a world of disarray. It begins with a deterioration in relations with the major powers, in particular Russia, to a lesser extent with China. You've got a Middle East that continues to unravel. The analogy I've used is the 30 years war in Europe, political religious struggles that lasted for decades and ignored borders, ultimately erased them. You've got a Europe that in just a couple of years has gone from the most stable, predictable, some might say boring part of the world to now anything but. The entire future of the European project is uncertain. You've got Russia in Ukraine in all sorts of ways. You've got North Korea on the verge of having nuclear weapons that can be put on missiles that could reach the United States. This will probably happen during Mr. Trump's first term, unless somehow it's head off. You've got the continuing reality of a rising China. You've got any number of global issues where the challenges far outpace or outstrip any consensus that might exist in the world about what to do about them. This is true from refugees to climate change to terrorism to what to do about disease and so forth. It's just part now of the reality of international relations. And you've got here domestically at home, you've got a country that is quite divided. We saw that in the election. This is Jim Lindsay's expertise. And there's not a consensus about America's role in the world. Indeed, one of the very few things that Mr. Trump, as well as Secretary Clinton, as well as Senator Sanders agreed on is that the pending trade relationship, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was consistent with, what, 6 or 7 decades of American foreign policy, was undesirable. And this now is also part of Mr. Trump's inbox because he has the unhappiness with the other 10 or so countries that signed this agreement with the United States, and a real question as to what to do in the economic trade space. But more broadly, what does this tell them about the predictability or reliability of the United States? And that's the last point I'd make. The last part of his inbox is to some extent the reaction to the campaign and the transition which is there's greater than the usual amount of concern out there, or make it more neutral, just uncertainty about what to expect from the United States. And so one of Mr. Trump's decisions is going to be, to what extent does he reassure and basically say, despite some of the rhetoric, there's going to be a whole lot more continuity than some would think? Or does he basically say, no, I want to embrace this uncertainty. I think you used the word disruptive, or I've heard it so much, someone's used it recently. To what extent does he want to play on this disruptive feature to try to keep people off balance? Is this going to be a staple of his approach to the world?
Richard, let me sort of draw you out on this issue of uncertainty. Mr. Trump takes office. He is the first person to be elected president with no previous government experience or military experience. And as you well know, transitions can be quite rocky. A new administration gets up and running, and you've served in four administrations. What is it like when you walk into administration on that first day, and all of a sudden, you're the ones who are in charge of making policy?
I'll tell you one story. When I was asked by Brent Scowcroft, who was the National Security Advisor, and President Bush 41, George Herbert Walker Bush, to head the part of the National Security Council staff that dealt with the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, in 1989. I showed up on the first day, and you show up in this ornate office in the old executive office building, which is filled with maybe 100 of those green, dark army green, four or five draw safes. The only problem was they were all empty. And then you go to your desk, there's no manual to do anything. And the reason, by the way, the safes are empty is all the stuff, all the papers have been shipped off to what will become the presidential library. It's properties of this president. The only thing that the secretariat, the permanent staff of the NSC has are formal presidential decision papers. My predecessors had left. Literally, I showed up, must have been 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and only one of my predecessors were still there, and he was walking out the door. So you sit down and you literally make it up.
And this is replicated across government. It's not just the staff of the NSC. It's in all of the cabinet agencies.
Oh,
political appointees are gone.
Every president gets to appoint roughly 4,000 people. There's no other country in the world which has this system. Traditionally, in most of the European countries or others, you maybe have a couple of dozen people who come in. The cabinet, possibly one or a few others around the president or prime minister, but the civil service is the permanent force. And while we have civil service in the United States, its role is proportionally much smaller, because the top echelon, it's places like the State Department, from deputy assistant secretary on up, or the Pentagon, or the Treasury, most of these people come in with the new president. Now, the assistant secretaries and above have the added challenge of getting confirmed. So the other thing that happens on day one is not simply that you walk into a lot of empty and underpopulated offices, but a lot of people still haven't been confirmed. And all of which to say is it takes months for a new administration to get up and running. The idea that the transition ends at noon on January 20th is dead wrong. The transition continues for months. So the challenge for the new administration is to identify and get its people into place, to think about the procedures, and then to test drive them a little bit. Every administration reforms its procedures, particularly after the new crisis. And I'd say one other thing, and I defer to Jim Lindsay on this a little bit. You also, since you are inheriting this world of disarray, as I would put it, you've also got to understand, though, what it is wise to try to get done in your first 100 days and what isn't. And I know the press and others are going to put tremendous pressure on Mr. Trump to show that he's changed the world. He himself is going to feel some of that pressure. Part of my advice would be just don't do something, stand there. Don't make a difficult problem that much worse. You're already inheriting a daunting inbox. You don't have to go out of your way to add to it. You know, you think about people like John Kennedy and what happened with the Bay of Pigs. I would say that presidents early on ought to move no faster than they need to. That they need to, again, the focus ought to be on getting the right people in place, thinking about your processes, getting people comfortable working with one another, getting people up to speed on the issues. There's a tremendous gap between the level of detail you deal with as an outsider and the level of detail you deal with as an insider. It is an order of magnitude. You don't govern with broad brushes for the most part. You're governing at the dots. And all this takes time. So part of my advice would be, don't feel you got to sprint. It's a marathon. Take it slow and be careful not to add to the already extraordinary set of challenges you inherit.
So that you anticipated partly my next question, which is what are the most common mistakes that are made in a new administration? You mentioned, you know, not having a manual, starting to make things up, but also this broader question of feeling like you need to act too quickly. Is that, would you say that's the number one common mistake, or what would you rank as common mistakes?
Almost all presidents want to announce that there's a new sheriff in town. And particularly after this election, because Mr. Trump is an outsider and this was a change election. So the expectations are high. But I would say you can go slow on that. I would say presidents, particularly ones who don't have a wealth of experience, need to get comfortable with what it is they've inherited procedurally, need to get a better fix on the people they've appointed. Even if you think you know them from the campaign, it's different when you govern. You govern with them. It's like a different sport, different muscle groups. Some people who might be good in a campaign aren't good in governing, and vice versa.
Well, you also have to get them to work together as a team. We tend to talk about them as individuals rather than how they all collaborate and work together.
Absolutely. And that's going to be, I think, a particular challenge in this administration because, say, unlike Bush 41, all these people knew each other. They'd all worked together in government in previous incarnations. Virtually none of these people have worked in government or worked with one another. And you've got a lot of them. You've not just have all the people at the agencies and departments, but now you've also got a fairly heavy White House staff. So making this work is going to be an extraordinary challenge. And again, it comes back to this idea of don't feel compelled to change things for the sake of changing them. I would advise any administration, start slowly. Get up to speed. Make sure you understand exactly what your inheritance is, not just what's out there in the world, but what the policy inheritance is. And make sure you have a better appreciation for why your predecessors came to that point. Because often, you know, these are tough problems. I mean, a perfect example, at the risk of getting ahead of ourselves, you know, there's a lot of pressure during the campaign, a lot of criticism of the Iran nuclear agreement. And I understand the criticisms. I'm quite sympathetic to some of the criticisms. But before you would go ahead and take dramatic action to quote-unquote tear it up or dramatically change how it's being implemented, you would want to think twice and maybe three times about what would be the repercussions of it. Would it necessarily leave you better off in dealing with Iran's nuclear problem? Would it isolate Iran or the United States? Do you want to take this on given the 87 other things you've got to worry about in the Middle East? That's the difference between campaigning, where you have the luxury of focusing on flaws, and governing, where you have the responsibility for living with an issue, for implementation.
Let's turn to substantive issues. And why don't we begin where you started with your wonderful sort of laying out of the issues that are going to be in the Trump foreign policy inbox. And you talk about the deterioration of major power relations. And you also write in your book, A World in Disarray, that this is one of the things you absolutely have to get right. Now, as I understand it, Mr. Trump is coming to office. He's been sharply critical of China, particularly on the economic front, but also somewhat on the security front, whereas he has talked and tweeted about rebuilding relations with Russia. And he has talked about how he wants to have a better relationship so he can work in collaboration. How do you assess what it is that Mr. Trump is doing here?
I'm not sure how to answer that in the sense that, but what he seems to be doing is calling into question his inheritance in both areas, essentially arguing that the U.S. is not being robust enough or tough enough in how it's responding to real or imagined problems coming out of Chinese foreign policy, and that we are, if anything, being too tough vis-a-vis Russia. I would say the two countries are not of equal import. I think China is the more important country. It's 10 times the population. Its economy is a real economy. It's not simply oil and gas dependent. It's integrated much more into international institutions. The relationship with China will be a far greater factor ultimately on the world, not simply during Mr. Trump's presidency, but beyond it. So I would make it a priority. China has not been behaving egregiously in the trade or economic area of late. It's not been manipulating its currency, for example. And I think the last thing we would need right now is a trade war with China. I mean, it reinforces what we were talking about a minute ago. What you don't do becomes just as important as what you do, and you've got to choose your priority. So the priority, I would say, is not to attack China over its trading practices, though that there's plenty of those that bother me, including subsidies and property theft and so forth. But I would say the biggest priority for China probably ought to be to try to get them on board to help deal with the North Korean challenge, which could well be the greatest national security challenge that Mr. Trump will face. North Korea is months or years away from being able to threaten American lives and cities directly. Now, will China do that? I don't know. I would want to take a serious run at it. I think our odds of getting them to work with us are far greater if we don't pick a fight with them over trade and if we don't pick a fight with them over Taiwan. Indeed, the Taiwan issue, I'd simply say, has been pretty well finessed for decades. So it's allowed the United States and China to get to the point where selective cooperation is a real possibility or in some cases a reality. So I would invest in that. I would both not get into a problem with China over trade or Taiwan, and or probably over their own internal politics. China this year faces their 19th party Congress. We're probably going to see a greater cracking down there, a greater tightening up politically. I would keep the focus on China. Probably number one would be on North Korea. Maybe number two would be the South China Sea. With Russia, it's a very different shape, and I'd make the intellectual point. It's similar to what I said at the beginning of what I was talking about with China. Better relations with Russia don't offset worse relations with China. And I'm not persuaded that better relations with Russia give us leverage or a tool over China.
Again, so you don't see this sort of an example of what they used to call trilateral diplomacy, play one off against
the
other?
I don't see this as a new triangle or anything like that. No, I don't think we get that kind of leverage. With Russia, I would show the Russians respect. I would be willing to talk to them about anything and everything. I would focus on Europe, and there's things I would talk to them about, obviously Ukraine. I do not think, though, they should get sanctions relief absent improved behavior. And I would also focus on a balance of power. And foreign policy depends not simply about coming to consensus with others, but it needs shaping their decision making. And one thing I would say we need to do is strengthen the forces that are, say, in Baltic countries. So Mr. Putin is not tempted to put pressure on them in the same way that he put pressure on non-NATO countries such as Ukraine. In the Middle East, again, it's a larger conversation, but there we need to think about what it is we're prepared to do in the Middle East. Then we can think about what we do vis-a-vis Russia. There was one other thing with Russia. Let me just say, obviously, given the entire hacking thing, one of the subjects on the agenda needs to be cyberspace. So it's not the narrow thing of did the Russians act this way or that way against Americans or against this or that company or individuals or parties, but we need to have serious conversation with the Russians and the Chinese and with others on setting up the rules for cyberspace. And we may or may not come to consensus, but people have to understand that if they act in certain ways, these will be the repercussions. And hopefully that would get them to think twice before they act in certain ways.
But speaking about Russia, I take it from reading your book and the conversation we just had that you don't think that the United States and Russia necessarily have mutual interests in places like Europe. The Russians in Europe seem to be trying to split NATO very much. And as a result, it's not simply a matter of getting along with the Russians as it is getting along with the Russians to advance our interests. They're not identical.
No, it's a distinction with a difference. I get nervous when people talk too much about good relations and an end in themselves. You can have great relations with countries if you're willing to put your own national interests to the side. I want to have better relations with Russia, but only if Russia shows greater respect for what we consider to be our vital national interests. So that's why, again, the Russians may not be happy with the military reinforcement of certain countries in NATO. Well, so be it. Again, I want to have a better relationship, but only on terms that respect and reflect what we consider to be our vital interest. I understand they have vital interests as well. Okay. That's a legitimate conversation. And whether we can find common ground or not, that's, you know, we will find out. I think it's in both countries' interest to have a ceiling on our disagreements, not to enter quote unquote a new Cold War. But we've got to be careful that the pursuit of better relations is not in and of itself an end.
Sticking with Europe for a second, Richard, we're seeing this this term coming out of Russia, desinformatsia, which was evoking the Cold War period and something the Soviets employed quite a bit. Is there a conversation that can be had on dealing with that, or is it more important to be countering that, for the U.S. to be able to counter that in the way it did successfully, many would say, during the Cold War? Or is it of a piece with the cyber norms discussion you were talking about, that maybe sides agree to rein things in?
It's not either or. I think one is to bring it up in the context of discussion of behavior in cyberspace. I think we've got to work with the Europeans about making them less vulnerable. We learned some lessons Russia enjoyed some successes it never should have been allowed to enjoy in terms of their access or penetration of this country. We also ought to talk to the Europeans about ways of pushing back, whether using cyber-related tools or other tools. It can't be a free ride. It can't be a cost-free pursuit for the Russians if they are going to try to in any way interfere with the proper workings of our societies. And it may be, you know, Mr. Putin, I think, is quite worried about quote-unquote colored revolutions. He's worried about his own political stability. He doesn't take it for granted. Okay. Well, there's things we could probably do to push back, certain information we can get out there. So this is the sort of conversation I think the new administration has to have with itself and then with the Europeans, because it's clear to me with the elections coming up over the next year in France and Germany that the Russians are not prepared to simply be bystanders. And they've got a lot of work with, given the rise of nationalist populist movements. The establishment is on its heels in Europe. And this is a dangerous time for the European project, which, by the way, has been one of the great creative accomplishments of the post-World War II era. It's, you know, the analogy I often use is oxygen. We tend to take it for granted. But you don't take oxygen for granted when you don't have it. Well, Europe without a European project, without the knitting together of the continent in ways that made violence and war unthinkable, which had, after all, been most of the history of Europe, is an extraordinary accomplishment. And we've got to do a lot or everything we can to see that that does not unravel.
Let's shift gears, Richard, and talk about the Middle East. Now, you, over the course of your career, spent a lot of time working on Middle East issues. You mentioned the piece you wrote in Foreign Affairs, likening what we're seeing in the Middle East as to the 30 Years' War, which was an extraordinarily destructive 30 years in Europe. How should the Trump administration think about the Middle East, particularly when you just begin ticking out the challenges they have? The Islamic State, Syria, Iran going nuclear, Saudi stability, Israeli-Palestinian negotiation. How do you prioritize? How are they related? Where do you start?
I would begin with trying to right-size America's Middle East policy. We don't want it to so dominate what we do in the world that we don't pay sufficient attention to Europe or Asia or other parts of the world. And one of the ways we, I think, do that is we avoid trying to remake the Middle East. It can't be our goal to make the Middle East democratic. It can't be our goal to make Syria and Libya and other countries perfectly whole again with governments in charge of every square inch of their territory. That's not going to happen anytime soon, if ever. I don't think we can bring peace right now between Israelis and Palestinians. There's just certain things in the Middle East that are beyond our reach, no matter how many calories or hours or people you throw at them. On the other hand, I don't want to take the other extreme of washing our hands of it. Bad things can emanate from the Middle East and affect us all. We've seen it with the refugee flows. We've seen it with terrorists. And that's where we'd begin. You want to go after the terrorists. You want to try to prevent refugee flows. You want to try to provide, I think, some security for people so they don't feel the need to leave where it is they are living. So I would put the emphasis on those two things in the positive way, to go after terrorists and to try to create conditions where we don't keep generating refugees. And I mentioned it before, I would not create a crisis with Iran over the nuclear agreement. That's something I would avoid doing. Instead, I would think much more about a focus on the geopolitical push of Iran around the region. How do we counter that in various places? And I would begin thinking about a follow-on nuclear agreement. I'm very worried. It won't be during Mr. Trump's presidency, but it'll probably be during his successor's presidency, that some of the quantitative ceilings on Iran in the nuclear space come off. Well, what happens then? As good as it is that Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon for 10 or 15 years, it's not much better if they get one in year 11 or 16. How do we prevent that? Well, we've got to start planning for that day. So I would put the focus on Iran's, what I would describe as imperial behavior around the region, and I'd begin to think about how we deal in the long run with its nuclear challenge.
So as far as the Middle East goes, the Trump campaign and really Trump to date has focused a lot on the ISIS threat in the Middle East, and he's made a point of repeating the shortcomings he sees as the Obama administration there, and he's going to once and for all deal with it. How do you advise that, given your comments about, you know, sort of taking things steadily?
I would actually, for the most part, stay the course on what we're doing going after ISIS. That means in Mosul, working with largely Iraqi government forces, also the Kurds, and going after ISIS in Mosul. I'd also go after ISIS in Raqqa in Syria. The challenge is going to be the day after, and the challenge will be twofold. One is when ISIS ceases to be a territorial entity, it's going to in some ways revert to an old-fashioned terrorist entity. That creates a different set of problems, but still a set of problems. We've got to make sure that all these people don't get to Europe or get to other countries. So that involves keeping them there and basically killing or capturing as many as we can. And then we've also got to think about the securing of the areas that are liberated, because you don't want an ISIS-like group to, and that means then working with, it could be Kurdish forces, it could be various Sunni groups, it could be neighboring states who might send some forces. It means coming up with a day after plan. One of the patterns of American national security policy now for decades has been that we're better at the front end of wars than we are at the back end of wars. And what we need to think about is, what is our policy for the back end? We don't want to, and we don't need to, and we should not have large footprints in terms of American soldiers. No one's talking about that again. But we do need to have a plan for the day after in the case of ISIS in Syria. I think we have a plan for the day after in Iraq. The question is whether the Iraqis can put aside their sectarianism, which has plagued them so many times in the past. But I think we have a bigger set of questions for the day after in Syria.
I want to change regions, if I may, Richard, and talk about another spot in the world that could be a major challenge for the Trump administration, that's North Korea. You alluded to this before. As you look at it, North Korea's nuclear program continues. Projections are that within 2 to 5 years, North Korea could have an intercontinental ICBM that could reach the United States. It already has shorter range missiles that threaten South Korea and Japan, and along with that, U.S. installations in the region. A lot of talk all along about how the United States should get China to put pressure on North Korea to rein in its program. Successive administrations have tried to do that. We haven't seen a lot of payoff. How should the Trump administration think about the North Korea challenge?
Well, it's going to be a real challenge, and what could make it an even bigger challenge is not simply what's happening in North Korea and their labs, but also what's happening in South Korea. And we could face a situation in a few months where our partner in Seoul will be much less of a willing partner, depending upon what kind of a government comes into power. Right now, you've got the whole impeachment situation there. So I'm just putting that out there, that as difficult as this situation is, it could become significantly
more. We're not the only ones affected by the North Korean threat. Japanese as well.
Exactly. What I'm most worried about potentially is the political outcome in Seoul if you had the impeachment of the current president and an election which brought into power someone who didn't want to have a robust policy towards North Korea. And I'm simply saying that could happen. I'm not predicting it, but I can't by any means rule it out. But putting that aside, I'm not a real optimist, to say the least, Jim, that negotiations with North Korea will work, that we can somehow negotiate our way out of this situation. History would suggest real skepticism about that. I would talk to China to see if the Chinese could use the leverage they say they don't have, but to a significant degree they do, and make it a real test case of the relationship. I think we could make them uncomfortable with the alternatives, and the alternatives at least are two and possibly three. One alternative is already underway, which is increasing air missile defense, which has some potential consequences for China's own nuclear systems. A second response is the reintroduction of nuclear weapons to that part of the world by the United States in ways that could make the Chinese unhappy. And thirdly, we should not rule out certain uses of force against North Korea, either in a preventive or a preemptive fashion. For example, if you had intelligence that North Korea was putting a nuclear-armed missile on alert, I wouldn't necessarily sit back. That might be the kind of situation which the United States has to act militarily. Now, there are things we can also put on the table with China that are incentives for them. That would be, we could have serious conversations about the future nature of the Korean Peninsula, about what a unified peninsula would look like, or even a divided peninsula would look like under different leadership in the North, or in the elimination of a separate state. A non-nuclear status, what it would mean for U.S. forces, how many, what kind, where they would be. They could move away from the 38th parallel. They could move away from, therefore, they'd be farther away from China. So I believe there's a serious conversation to be had here with China. I'm not predicting it will succeed, but if not, then we're going to have to get very serious, essentially about two options, which is whether we're prepared to live with a North Korea that has this kind of a missile and nuclear threat, and we'd have to deter and defend against it, or we would have to think about under what circumstances, using various tools from cyber to military, what we might do against North Korea. But my own view is that the era of sanctions and diplomacy has likely run its course, and that's, I just don't see that solving this problem for us.
So would that mean then that this what you have called the World Order 2.0 is going to have to deal with issues like nuclear proliferation in a different way than the 1.0 world in terms of sanctions and diplomacy are going to need to be handled differently?
It's a good question. The emphasis on the world we've known is non-proliferation was largely a preventive problem. The world had all sorts of constraints about the flow of technology and capabilities, and the idea was to slow or prevent countries from crossing the threshold. I think that continues. That's still necessary, but it's not sufficient. Increasingly, what we need to have is a greater consensus of what to do about countries that become nuclear, that they cross the threshold. Well, then the problem doesn't go away. It intensifies, and you've already got four countries besides the original five that have nuclear weapons now. And we potentially have others down the road. Iran is the one that's most pressing, and we want to prevent it for all the obvious reasons. But North Korea is, I think, the most immediate challenge as a case study of a country that's crossed that threshold. And what's to prevent North Korea not just from developing missiles, but from doubling or tripling or quadrupling the size of its nuclear inventory, the way Pakistan has? We don't want that to happen. So, yes, I do think this set of issues needs to be on the table.
Richard, we've talked a lot about threats facing the United States and the Trump administration. Do you see opportunities out there? Are there sort of regions or countries or issues where you think we can make significant progress?
I do think there are opportunities. Well, one is India. It's 1.3 billion people. And I think the opportunities, and this is, by the way, it's been happening for decades now. It's been bipartisan. But I see lots of upside with the Indian economies. And I think the U.S.-Indian economic relationship can grow, as should and could the U.S.-Indian strategic relationship. I'm very optimistic about our hemisphere. I look at big parts of Latin America, as well as, you know, obviously looking north. This part of the world has virtually no geopolitics. I'm not worried about interstate wars. No, I'm worried about state weakness in a couple of cases, the problems with dealing with drugs and criminal gangs. I'm worried about Venezuela, but I'm not worried about Brazil and Argentina going to war tomorrow. I'm not worried about nuclear proliferation in this part of the world. I see you have a lot of democracies. You've got a lot of potential for economic growth. One question I think for the Trump administration is whether or where it comes out on trade. I think that's a real tool. It's a real tool for promoting not just economic growth, but promoting development around the world. It can also be a way of discouraging countries from upsetting the apple cart and using military force. So I would hope that the Trump administration would find a way back, if not to the quote-unquote traditional American approach to trade, to something that's awfully close to it. I think we're denying ourselves a real economic and political and strategic tool. There may be also some opportunities elsewhere, and we talked about cyber, dealing with global health, dealing with certain, even with climate change. There might be areas of global cooperation which could continue to advance, particularly if they're designed in ways that don't seem to be at cross purposes with sovereignty or American independence to make its own decisions. And I think that's quite possible. We've seen it in climate, we've seen it in health, and I think we could see it in some other realms as well.
Well, on that note of opportunity, we'll close up this series of episodes on the Trump transition for the President's Inbox. This podcast, first introduced as a limited run series dedicated to covering the issues facing the next president, is going to continue on a regular basis beyond inauguration. We will offer the same format, taking a deep dive into a single issue with guest experts. Richard, thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back again.
Thanks for having me, gentlemen.
Please be sure to subscribe on iTunes and also leave us a review. We read them all, and they help us fine-tune our shows for you, our listeners. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock and recording engineer Glenn Goldman. Also, special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening.